You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
You did feel you were in the spy capital of the world, and you did feel you were very much at the center of the Cold War.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
Welcome to episode 34 of Cold War Conversations. I do hope you are enjoying the content, and please leave reviews on iTunes or alternative podcast platforms and share us on social media. It helps raise the profile and helps get us some new guests. Today we talk with Sammy, who as a native West Berliner describes growing up in the city during the 1970s and 80s. He describes in detail the difference between West Berlin and West Germany, including its position as a special political entity, how the death penalty in West Berlin was only abolished in 1989, and how, as a child, he was obsessed with spy movies, spy books, and Cold War activities. Before we go further, I'd like to thank all our Patreons who donate monthly to support the podcast further and get access to some exclusive extras. Luke Wooler is our latest Patreon, who pay as little as £1 or $1 a month to help keep us broadcasting and expanding the show. Just go to the website at coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option. Okay, so back to today's episode. Sammy also talks about the battle between the East and West German Sandmenschen, resulting in victory for the East. Sammy joined the Red Cross post-Cold War and discovered some interesting remnants of preparedness in case of another Berlin blockade, including some top secret locations. I'm sure you will enjoy his account, and I am delighted to welcome Sammy to Cold War Conversations. Sammy, welcome to Cold War Conversations. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ian.
I'm really interested to hear your story, because you've probably seen on the podcast I've had a lot of the view from East Germany, but your point of view is particularly interesting because it's the view West Berlin. So could you just tell me a little bit about your childhood and growing up in West Berlin?
Yeah, sure. I think it's also very interesting to kind of put that together a little bit with what we've heard from the East, but also what we've heard from some of the service members from the Allied forces in some of your previous podcasts. So I think your listeners are probably familiar with the fact that Berlin was really not a normal place. But of course, when you grow up in it, a place just seems to you, well, you know, that's normal life. So Berlin was not technically a part of the Federal Republic in as much as, for example, the GDR didn't consider it to be part of Germany. It was a special, I think they called it a political entity, self-dependent political entity of West Berlin, I think. Mm-hmm. And the special status or the history of the city was kind of permeating your youth in many ways as well. So you'd have a lot of traces of the Second World War still around you. The other day I just walked past my primary school and I could see the bullet holes have gone. So they've, you know, kind of took 50 years or so to remove the traces of the Second World War.
Yeah.
From the school. And a lot of the things that were going on in school, stories from the teachers were very colored by the post-war years, the 1953 17th of June, and the blockade. So right from a very early age, you were kind of made aware you're living on this island of freedom, surrounded by the sea of communism in a way.
And were you conscious of, or were there people around you who had come over from the East before the wall was built?
Before the wall?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't think people would have necessarily mentioned that.
Right.
So, no, I'm not really aware of that. There were, in secondary school, there were quite a few who kind of, whose parents came over after the wall was built, legally. So you could apply to leave East Germany, and then you would set yourself up for a very unpleasant process that could last several years and could be denied, could end up with you in prison, all kinds of difficulties. But quite a number of people did manage to leave the country legally. They were kind of bought by West Germany from the East Germans.
Yeah. Yeah. And were these people who weren't necessarily skilled like doctors or people like that? There were people that the East Germans weren't overly fussed about leaving?
Yeah, I think on the one hand those, and on the other hand there were those who were highly educated but who East Germany was quite happy to see the back of. So, there was a girl in my class in secondary school whose parents were both university professors, and they were obviously quite difficult in the Eastern times. And so it was something between being expelled and leaving the country in their case. But of course, you're always aware of the stories of people coming over the wall illegally and kind of getting killed or making it or managing to escape somehow. And the West Berlin media was also kind of playing that up. You saw, rescue equipment at the canal kind of put in a position to allow you to help somebody who's kind of made it into the canal to come out on the western side and all these things.
Okay. And what were your teachers like at school? Were they were some of them of a left-wing persuasion or not?
I suspect most of my, certainly primary school teachers, were much more on the conservative side. So for them, the enemy was clearly the East. And I don't think this was any kind of directed political indoctrination, because my main primary school teacher, I still talk to her today, and she holds these views and she has these experiences. Personal experiences of the blockade in particular, which kind of was a recurring theme with some of these older teachers, how people coped, how they cooked, where they got their food from, how difficult it was to live in those years. Those were kind of stories they would, retell. Or then obviously also going back to the war, warning us of picking up ammunition when we go playing in the forests or in abandoned facilities of some kind. I think certainly in primary school, most of them were on the conservative side. In the secondary school, there was a funny incident. we had a political comparison of the East and West German system as a topic at school. And the teacher made a point of not writing BRD, which is a kind of typical abbreviation for West Germany, Bundesrepublik Deutschland, but she would every time write out Bundesrepublik Deutschland. So we asked her, what's the story? And she said when she was a trainee teacher, she once wrote comparison DDR-BRD onto the blackboard. And within an hour, she was called to the headmaster and he asked her, are you a communist? Because the West was very keen on not being put on an equivalent playing field of BRD, DDR. These are two equivalent states.
Yeah.
So the very conservative headmaster kind of, that raised an immediate alarm. He kind of had to challenge her. And our music teacher, by contrast, if I look at it retrospectively, he kind of taught us a lot of Russian songs, which is a kind of a weird thing to happen in West Berlin. at the time, I never remarked it, but kind of now, whenever I hear something Cold War related or Russian, I was like, oh, hold on, we had that at school. And you kind of wonder, you know, was there an element of kind of being on the more on the Russian side?
Yeah. So when you weren't at school, what did you do in your spare time?
There was a lot to do in Berlin. There were excellent facilities sports-wise, which of course for a young boy is something great. You had leisure facilities, but there were also the great forests. I mean, yes, we were a walled-in city. We're kind of an open prison, if you would like to put it like that. But in reality, it's a huge green city with forests and lakes and as I'm sure you have visited many times. So there's a lot to do. I fenced competitively already at a pretty young age. And there were a lot of opportunities to immerse yourself in culture. You could go to museums for free. There were a lot of museums in the West, now not so much anymore. You could go to the Berlin Philharmonic if you wanted to for 8 marks, if you were a pupil in a Berlin school. And it was just a big playground in a way.
So was the city, I know that the Allied forces were quite heavily subsidized. So was there a lot of subsidies coming into, you know, that benefited the West German, sorry, the West Berliners?
Yes, definitely. So when I had my first job, and this was already after the wall had fallen, that must have been 92 or something. And, you know, I was just cutting off tickets for people entering the planetarium. And I still got a 4% top up on my pay, paid for by the West German government. And that used to be 8% when the wall was still there. That everybody, every working Berliner would get on top of their salary to make Berlin an attractive place for people to live in. You had laws that would prohibit until 1987 the raising of rents in inner city West Berlin. Downside of that was the real estate was in really bad condition. So the bullet holes was not just a function of the state not wanting to renovate things, but also landlords had no incentive to renovate things because rents were heavily regulated. But that allowed a kind of freedom that attracted many people from West Germany. And in fact, when the wall came down, the population of West Berlin was not in the majority born West Berliners. There were a lot of people who'd come from Western Germany. Also, of course, the appeal of not having to go to the army, which became quite a concern for us pretty quickly when the wall fell. So I think from 1990 onwards, we kind of felt a little bit that our birthright of not having to go to the army was robbed by the reunification. And there were many small things that were done in order to make living in West Berlin more attractive or relieve life in West Berlin. So pubs didn't have to close, unlike West Germany. They could be open all night. Telephone calls within Berlin were very cheap compared to West Germany. So there were a lot of freebies available, both for children and for adults.
Right. And, you know, as a child, did you, you know, go to the movies a lot or read books?
Well, it was mostly television, of course. I still remember even primary school watching my first Bond, and the next day the teacher was trying to find out who watched the Bond film. She kind of made everybody confess that they were allowed to watch the Bond film. Then she wrote to all our parents telling us it's not suitable for children to watch.
What age were you when you watched that?
That must have been 11, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. 11, yeah. I mean, everybody did. So it was kind of the thing to do. But there were many TV programs about espionage. It was always in the back of your mind. You saw news coverage of spy exchanges. It was kind of, you did feel you were in the spy capital of the world. And you did feel you were very much at the center of the Cold War. So even as children, we would kind of discuss, well, you know, what would be the siren signal if there was a nuclear attack, or how long would it take for the Soviet missiles to arrive, and all that. Macabre, almost absurd thoughts, really.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you must have seen quite regularly, you know, the Allied personnel around the city as well.
Yeah. So most weekends, my friends and I, we kind of took the bicycles and went to the Grunewald. And you had obviously the Teufelsberg towering very high, but that was...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
You know, that was not such an attractive destination because it was actually patrolled. But the Allies did have some smaller facilities in the Grunewald as well, you know, antenna arrays and stuff. And there were these barbed wire fences, and it said, you're not allowed to take notes, photographs, or draw pictures on penalty. It was some absurd amount of money, $100,000 or imprisonment or something like that. So we were obviously kind of tempted by that, and we did sneak a compact camera once and kind of just took photos, completely meaningless, of course, but just the thrill of doing the illegal. I remember another weekend where it felt there were like 2,000 American soldiers running and jogging and chanting like they do in these American films, you know, kind of one guy chanting and the rest chanting after that. So you'd see that a lot. I lived in the British sector. You saw the British military police quite a bit. In the Grunewald, you also saw the Americans sometimes. And of course, if you went north, the French, in around their barracks quarters, there were a lot of French soldiers. But I also knew families where there had been a French father, for example.
And how much were you aware of the West Berlin subculture?
That really kind of settled in around 12, I suppose, when I had my first friend who was really into, you know, the kind of David Bowie, all these kind of people who flocked for the music scene to Berlin. And then a little bit later, there was also a friend who was extremely, or had extremely left-wing political views, and who kind of went to almost subversive meetings in Kreuzberg, and it was kind of almost an RAF, as in Red Army faction, supporter.
Yeah.
And you know, he would make a point of never ever paying to use public transport, and I think he managed that through his entire time at school to never ever pay for the public transport. But you could certainly tell that there were those elements. So there were a graffiti on the wall calling for the release of the Red Army faction prisoners, for example. Those kinds of things were very present. You had the squatting and subsequently the removal of squatters, which is kind of a big subject. You had the, and you still do to some extent, the riots in Kreuzberg on the 1st of May every year. But of course, that's much diminished in past years. But particularly in the late 80s, that was a very... very intense conflict. And in fact, at one point, the GDR also got involved when the West Berlin police tried to clear a squad at the border, and the East German police kind of threatened the West German police for shooting the water cannon over the wall, warning them that this is the territory of the GDR. Do not fire your water cannon onto the territory of the GDR. And subsequently, the last of the squatters, I think, managed to escape over the wall and were actually given an S-Bahn ticket by the East German authorities, simply on the ground of my enemy's enemy is my friend. Although, of course, the East would have never tolerated these people had they been in the East.
Yeah, because I remember there was an area near Potsdamer Platz. I think it was the Lenner Triangle.
The Lenner Triangle, yes.
Where it was GDR territory, but because of the wall, the East Germans had decided not to wall that section off.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, the entire strip just before the wall was East Germany. So, you know, once I went near the Brandenburg Gate with a friend, we were playing right by the wall, and then suddenly an East German border guard turned up on the western side, telling us to, you know, leave the GDR, basically.
And did you have any other ties? Because I think you'd mentioned to me that you visited some friends in Kreuzberg where you could see the wall.
Yes, indeed. So my mum would very frequently, I'm not sure it was weekly, but for me it was very frequently, visit a friend, and there, you know, was a couple of ladies coming together, and they'd bring their children to Kreuzberg, and they were having a kind of Sunday afternoon tea meeting, and we children would be playing, but from the large apartment, you could see on the back, you could see the entire East German border array. So there was first the river, and then you had a set of walls towards the west. Then you had the Death Strip, and then the Eastern Wall, which is, of course, kind of a much neater, cleaner wall, because no graffitis, no dirt, cleaned regularly, I presume. There was certainly a kind of very, that stuck in my mind, that part. It's not far from not far from Schlesisches Tor, so by the Oberbahnbrücke, that area. And it felt, you kind of really recognize the place a little bit when you see the, you know, the Smiley film, the BBC one. And now the bridge, obviously, on that is not that bridge. I think they filmed that in Manchester. But the scene in the cafe, I'm pretty sure that was filmed there, because it so typically catches these kind of Turkish cafes. And I think that's another cultural thing that came together in West Berlin at the time. You had a lot of Turkish migrants, and Kreuzberg had a completely different feel from where I was living on the Kurfürstendamm, which was kind of clean and glitzy, and shops and nice cars. And Kreuzberg was much more really basic, with people. I mean, there were some nice apartments, but a lot of people lived with outside toilets, had to carry up coal. I remember we got a new math teacher once who moved into one of these flats when he moved to Berlin. He kind of said, oh, I had to carry up the coal 5 floors this morning. It was a very poor and dirty place in parts, West Berlin. And I think also, if you see kind of footage and films filmed in that period in Berlin, what strikes you first is really how dirty it was. And I think that's something people get wrong if they make movies supposedly set in that period, and probably not only for Berlin, probably also for other places, just how dirty the 80s in a way were.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was interviewing, I think it was Sabina, about her experiences of first crossing from the east into the west, and she crossed at Oberbahnbrücke, and she remarked on, they were shocked at how dirty it was when they came over.
It's true. I mean, it is true. Berlin was not very clean, really, at the time. And I marvel every time at how little dog dirt there is today compared to back then. just to kind of give one example. So not all has turned worse, even though some people kind of look back nostalgically to the past. There was quite a bit of dirt and poverty going on as well. And there were a lot of people whose lives were not the kind of perfect Western image. But by and large, obviously, the city or the state did try to project the image of, well, this is the shop window of the West. We're showing the best we have. And equally, of course, on the Eastern side, this is the shop window of the East. And this is the best the East has to offer.
And I understand you managed to visit the Reichstag before Norman Foster got his hands on it.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that was exciting. That was actually during the when Christo wrapped it. So this was after the wall came down, but before Norman Foster got in. And you could still, I mean, the person who led me around and showed me the kind of the Russian graffiti, some of which they kept from immediately after Berlin was liberated by the Red Army. So Russian soldiers kind of leaving their names and what have you. And crazy to kind of go there now, because of course the Reichstag in those days was really at the edge of our island. You know, and people would play football in front of it. It was basically at the edge of an old building at the edge of a public park. It did not have the kind of special status it's holding today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And right up against the wall there next to Brandenburg Gate.
Exactly, yeah. And really not an attractive place in any way, because it's kind of surrounded on the wall by the wall on two sides, and there is just nothing there, or was nothing there.
You mentioned that you learned later that the Allies were eavesdropping on West Berliners and opening their mail.
Yeah, that was breaking. You know, that was kind of a news item for a while, a couple of years after the wall came down, and then kind of disappeared. Nobody really questioned further what exactly was this. But I think what people don't realize is that while West Berlin did have a parliament and a mayor and so on, the ultimate lawmaker was still the Allied Control Council, the Alliierte Kontrollrat, and that there was simply a Kontrollratsgesetz that regulated the life of the Berliners, and the Allies could, at their whim, change the law. So West Berlin, theoretically, wasn't practiced since, I think, 1949. West Berlin, theoretically, until March 1989, still had the death penalty. For offenses as trivial as, I think, theft of Allied property was the least thing you could get killed for in theory. There was a legal obligation to carry ID. You know, kind of a lot of these laws written immediately after the war, where it would make sense, you know, somebody without ID should be possibly arrested to find out who this person is. But of course, in the 1980s, doesn't really make much sense anymore. Yeah, it's a strange field, but I suppose that's kind of how history unfolds. You know, one system loses, the other wins, and the winning system doesn't really have to show its cards in terms of what it did to spy on its citizens and find out things. I heard an item recently on the radio that apparently the same happened with the packages that people sent to their relatives in the East. And then there was a fear in some cases in the West that people would send secret documents or something like that to the East German spy agencies, and that the people who opened these packages in the West didn't put much effort in closing them again, because they said, well, people will assume anyway it was the Stasi.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's interesting, because I think one of my other guests mentioned that, you know, it appeared to be obvious that the Stasi had opened packages from the West. I'm not sure whether these were sent from West Berlin or West Germany, but it's interesting hearing that side of it as well.
I mean, it's probably both, right? Yeah. I mean, if you're unlucky, both yeah. sides will have opened your package. On the other hand, these packages were an important lifeline also from a political perspective for the East German government. So I don't know if you've probably been to the East German Museum in East Berlin.
The DDR Museum.
Yeah. And they kind of, in one exhibit, they mentioned that apparently it was part of the five-year plan how much coffee would be sent from the West to the East. You know, so they only needed to account for a lesser amount of coffee for the population because a certain amount would be sent by relatives from the West.
Yeah.
And coffee was certainly, together with fruits, coffee was certainly one of the big items that people wanted to have.
You'd also told me some interesting detail about you worked at the Red Cross, I think, after the war, but you know, you learnt more about some of the preparations for a second Berlin blockade.
So a major concern for the West German authorities was, what if there was a repeat of the blockade? What if the Soviets decide to close down the roads, waterways to Berlin, and you'd have to get back to a second Berlin airlift? And the West German government has set itself, or the West Berlin government had set itself, the objective of providing for, I think it was at least 6 months, with resources present in Berlin. And so some of these resources were managed by the Red Cross. And even though a lot of the food and daily life supply had been given away.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
When there was a particularly bad winter in Russia, I think it was 1991, those supplies had been given away. There were still some supplies which the Red Cross was managing, and the Red Cross was still kind of on a Cold War footing, if you will. Right? So you were told, well, you have to sign this paper. It's secret that we have these. In this case, it was some kind of beds for people to sleep on. It's secret that we have these stored at this garage in Königin Elisabethstraße.
Oh, you
have
know
to sign.
That.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they're still there.
Oh, okay, you're safe.
Not likely. And you have to kind of certify that you were privy to the secret and you're not to reveal it. But then again, you weren't really privy to much. You were only privy to a very small part of it, right? And then there was a very good book, Die Umstände zwingen zur Bewirtschaftung, which was published afterwards, and which came in a set with food stamps that were held ready in case of another blockade. And it's incredible the amount of detail. I mean, like children's clothing to account for 1 year's growth of children in Berlin. Toilet paper. Part of the official supply were also cows, right, believe it or not. Which kind of comes in if you kind of look into the Chernobyl, a disaster, actually, because that's when I actually learned for the first time that we had live cows in Berlin. You could buy their milk. So there were a lot of features that the West German government or the West Berlin government had in order to cope with potential threats. Right? Another feature was the voluntary police reserves. So when the East Germans allowed the NVA, the National Volksarmee, to form and to be present in East Berlin, the West thought, well, we can't install military because we object to military in Berlin on the eastern side and we'd be hypocritical. But they found what they call the Voluntary Police Reserve, a kind of paramilitary police made up of volunteers who could, in theory, be called up to I suppose, aid the Allied troops in, you know, in house-to-house combat.
Yeah.
If it came to that. Unfortunately, that kind of became a little bit of a collection of slightly politically questionable people to some extent, and was dissolved in the 2000s for that reason.
As part of the Red Cross, did you see any of the bunkers and things like that, or were you just restricted to these storehouses?
So the Red Cross did not really have anything to do with that until it came to it, right? So the Red Cross would be mobilized and told, right, you are in charge of this facility and you provide the food and blankets or whatever for this bunker. But I was lucky that in my Red Cross unit, there was the lady who had the keys to all the bunkers in Berlin, because that was her day job. She was some kind of official of the civil defense. And all the bunkers, she just had a car, and in the car were all the keys for all the bunkers. And we did have more bunkers than the rest of West Germany in Berlin. So the coverage would not have been the same as, say, in Switzerland or Albania. But Berlin did have a pretty good bunker coverage. Some of that was obvious and known. So everybody in my school knew about the bunker and the Kudammkarree, and it was signposted, you know, in the shopping mall, bunker. But a lot of the underground stations, for example, hold huge bunkers. And the idea would be that if a nuclear confrontation seemed likely, these bunkers would then be made operational. So the Red Cross would put in the beds and start kind of getting these bunkers up to speed so that when the alert came, people could flee into these bunkers and be safe. Right. That was kind of the idea behind that. Thankfully, this never was put into action. And also, since that lady had all the keys and her car didn't have any blue lights or sirens, I kind of wonder how, in a fast-developing situation, how she would have opened all these bunkers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, West Berlin is often referred to as an island within East Germany, and obviously geographically it was, but there were some services that had to work in conjunction with the East German authorities, weren't there?
Indeed, yeah. For example, rubbish collection. So we paid the East to take care of our rubbish, and there was even a special border crossing for the rubbish vans. Downside of that, I don't know whether that's from rubbish burning, but there was always a terrible smell in the winter. Yeah, I think that probably because of the coal heating going on in the East.
Yeah, because they used lignite, didn't they, for heating?
Yeah, exactly. The Braunkohle, as we call it. So some days cars were banned from driving. You had to have a special job. You had to be a doctor or a nurse or a policeman to be allowed to drive. But of course, whatever measures we took on the western side would never lift the problem that we had this eastern climatic effect. And in fact, I would say 1990 or 1991 was probably the first winter in my youth where this just didn't happen anymore. For some reason, the air was clear in the winter, and I couldn't believe it, that, you know, the snow wasn't brown from whatever was in the air. So it was kind of one effect you could really immediately feel. So you're very sensitive to the direction of the wind and the smell the city would suddenly get if the wind came from the wrong direction. And I mean, our everyday life was, in a way, a symbiosis with the East, right? I mean, we watched East German television. West German television was very influenced by East German television. Sandman is a good example. I think that he was already mentioned on some of your programs, the Sandmännchen children's TV program. So the West German television had also commissioned a Sandmann program. And the East kind of started a TV program race, and they came out with their Sandmann first. There was a huge pressure to come out with theirs first, and theirs was much better. So I think within 3 months or so, the West German Sandmann had died, and children just watched the East German Sandmann.
So East Germany had at least one victory in the Cold War, the Battle of the Sandmen.
Exactly, yes. And I mean, to be fair, I think a lot of the Eastern European children's movies were just simply superior to anything I remember from West German television, particularly as a young child, I would say.
Yeah.
So they're kind of fairy tale, you know, the Czech or Polish fairy tale movies. They were just great and believable and well done.
Yeah, I think I mentioned in one of the previous episodes that in the UK we had the Singing Ringing Tree.
I've never seen that.
Which was, I only discovered about 6 months ago, it was produced in East Germany, and that was particularly unnerving and disturbing. but yeah, no, some quality stuff produced. It's interesting hearing that you were watching East German TV, because you sort of, you imagine that the West Germans would have just, you know, ignored it as an inferior product possibly. So did you watch East German TV news or anything like that?
No, I think the news were really not interesting on the East German side, right? I mean, it was just more, that was really more a fun item to hear them say the Vorsitzende des Staatsrats der DDR and whatever. And, you know, they have to give the full title to Erich Honecker every time they mention his name. That was just amusing, I would say. But they did have great educational programs. So I was always into everything English, even before we started learning it at school. And my first English lessons were actually the East German English TV program, English for You, it was called.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of episodes of those on YouTube.
Okay, I didn't know it was on YouTube. Okay.
Yeah, there's a couple of episodes there, and they are quite fun. I can't work out whether the guy who's speaking the English is actually English. He does seem to have quite a...
Because they had two of those. There was an early one, which was apparently quite communist and so on. And then they had a later one, which they kind of designed a little bit, you know, Shakespeare and just normal British life.
It was a later one, I think. And it was almost magazine program like, you know, they were visiting Rostock and... You know,
okay, no, well, the one I remember kind of went actually to the UK. So they would, you know, on the Shakespeare thing, they would go to Stratford and Avon.
Oh, wow.
So.
Well, hopefully somebody will put that episode up. I think that would be an interesting one.
I would be really interested to see it again. Yeah. So yeah. You know, that would be a fun reminiscence. And in a way, that's what I meant earlier when I said there was an influence. We also had a lot of educational TV in West German television. And all of that, the East German and the West German educational television, had kind of disappeared within 2 years after the falling of the war. So it's almost as if there was a competition to say, you know, we have the superior cultural educative program. And the moment the competition ended, the programs ended. And it was all just about, well, we want whatever gets the highest viewer numbers.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, you know, like when I speak to former East Germans, you know, in their schooling, they were told, oh, the West is really bad and, you know, there's nothing good over there. Was that the perspective that you were given of the East, or was it more nuanced and, I don't know, even-handed or not?
I think particularly the older teachers certainly had a view that, you know, the East was an evil power. And the people were okay, but their government is criminal, and communism is evil. But many people had a more nuanced view of everyday life in East Germany, because, of course, many people, ourselves included, had relatives in the East. So, you know, we had the ability to compare directly. And every West Berliner had the right to travel to East Berlin. So... You could just go across. I think there was no point in indoctrinating us in any way about the East. There was, so the East had a propaganda television program that was going on every week about the evils of the West and kind of what's wrong in the West. And there was an answer program in the West for that. There was one specific to Berlin in the earlier years, but then later on there was a German one. I think it was called Kennzeichen D.
Yeah.
And that was kind of their answer, but it was a little bit more subtle than the Eastern one.
Yeah, it was the Eastern one called the Black Channel or something like that.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, der Schwarze Kanal. So, you know, there was a little bit of that going on, and people would make references to the freedom of the city. But there was also, around the 750th anniversary of Berlin in 1987, there was a lot of cross-city events going on. So there was a kind of active attempt to create some kind of we're all Berliners view.
Right.
And of course the West's objective was always reunification, whereas the East's objective was to keep separate. So, you know, you couldn't paint it all dark in the East. You could paint it all dark from the Eastern perspective, but from Western perspective, you always had to keep the door open to, well, we want you to come back.
Yeah, yeah. And the East German perspective is quite interesting because obviously one of the lines of their national anthem was about reunification. Yeah, that was almost the last thing they...
I think they had a beautiful anthem and it would have been a great symbol to say, you know, we just take that anthem.
Yeah.
Also because it has no background in pre-war times, of course. But that decision was taken differently.
Yeah. Well, I think I read somewhere there was talk of using at least one verse as part of a unified German anthem.
And it works. You could sing the East German text to the West German melody. It does
right.
work. I tried it once. but it didn't happen. Yeah. So, and also, I mean, the text was banned, or not banned, but nobody sang it in the East from whenever, some point in the 60s onwards.
Well, that's all we had time for this episode. If you enjoyed Sammy's story, I'm delighted to say there is more. A second episode will be coming soon where we hear about Sammy's trips into the GDR to visit his relatives. There's some great videos in the show notes, particularly one of West Berlin squatters being welcomed over the wall by East German border guards. The show notes are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 34. There's also some different outro music this week based on one of the subjects we discussed in the podcast. I hope you enjoy it. If you can't wait till the next episode, do join our Facebook discussion group where there's loads of Cold War information and further discussions with our guests and others. Just go to Facebook and search Cold War Conversations. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. Lastly, if you like what you're hearing, do leave reviews with your podcast provider. It really helps to spread the word. Thank you very much for listening and supporting us. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.